Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 21st. Representative Gunther moves approval of the minutes from January 20th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, today is Housing Day. The first item on our agenda is we're going to do an overview from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and we are lucky enough to have the Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency join us today. So if the Commissioner and her entourage would like to approach the table. And while we're getting set up, members, I would just like to point out in your packets, you'll see something from the Center for the Energy and Environment that's in your handout. This is an energy policy forum that will be taking place on the 27th. Where, in case you don't think you get to hear me talk enough, you actually get to hear me talk more. And there'll be some other people there, though. So, a good conversation with the Center for Energy and the Environment. Hope you get a chance to attend. It is in the evening, so it should work with schedules. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. My name is Mary Tinkerthal, and I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which I joined 4 years ago. Just right about now. And it's really an honor to have the opportunity this early in the session to provide the committee members with an overview of what we do at Minnesota Housing. And sitting to my left is Ryan Baumtrog, who will be joining Minnesota Housing next Wednesday as our Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development. He is currently at Minnesota Management and Budget and has served in the past as our Executive Budget Officer, so he knows the agency well. So thank you, Ryan, for being here today before you've even gotten a chance to start. So Minnesota Housing is a rather unusual state agency. We are sort of a standalone state agency in that our statute really creates the agency in a way that allows us to issue bonds to investors all over the country, all over the world, and they carry the rating of the agency, not of the state of Minnesota. And so our statute really designs the agency in such a way that we can take the most opportunistic advantage of tools that are made available to us largely by the federal government. And as you'll see in a few moments, the vast majority of the dollars that are expended by the agency do not come from the state. Certainly the dollars that we have received through appropriations are extremely important, but we use them in a way that we leverage many other resources, both private and federal. Our mission is pretty simple. We finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. And that last part of our mission really talks about the fact that we don't just put money out to finance housing. We really put money available to communities that are really looking to resolve housing issues that they face. So the issues that are faced by the city of Jackson are likely going to be pretty different from the issues that might be faced by the suburb of Golden Valley. And so what we try to do is work with communities in a way that they know which resources are available, how they can access those resources, and how they can use these state and federal resources to really address the housing issues in their community. Let me start by talking a little bit about the current environment out there. As we're looking at an economic recovery, it may be easy to think that housing is really not much of an issue. But as the case truly is, about 600,000 households in Minnesota are what we call cost burdened. And what that means, and I'll go into this in a little more detail later, is that those families are paying more than 30% of their income for housing, whether that's home ownership or rental. About 600,000 households in Minnesota are in that situation. In addition, according to the latest count, somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 Minnesotans are homeless on any given night. And we'll talk more about what some of the dynamics of that are. Some of the other dynamics that are happening in the marketplace right now is that there are very low rental vacancy rates. And you say, well, why should, isn't that a good thing? Why should I care about that? The issue with low rental vacancy rates is that that's the time when rental rates tend to go up. It's supply and demand. If there's low vacancy rates, then rents are going to go up, and the affordability issue gets even tougher. The other thing we're experiencing is rising construction costs. We particularly in the western and northwestern part of the state are seeing that it's very difficult to compete with the western oil fields for contractors, and we've seen costs particularly go up over the last year. We also have growing preservation needs. I'll show you in a minute a map of where the existing housing that Minnesota Housing has financed over the last 40 years is located, and much of that housing was built 35 to 40 years ago, and we found over the years, I think on a over the course of many administrations, that it's very cost effective to keep that housing healthy and to make some investments in that housing that already exists. Other good news is that the foreclosure rate is declining. When I started 4 years ago, we were still in the midst of a really deep recession, and many people faced with losing their homes. And thankfully, we're seeing much of that problem in the rearview mirror. But the counterpart of that is that there are still a lot of barriers in the system to home ownership. So a lot of the conservatism that I think rightly came into the lending markets is making it difficult often for first-time home buyers to be able to acquire a home. And I think that's one of the things that makes some of the programs that Minnesota Housing offers particularly important at this time. We do have a strategic plan, which has five priorities. We'll be rewriting that strategic plan this year to see if any of those priorities need to shift just a little bit. Just quickly, preserving federally assisted rental housing, which I talked about, promoting and supporting successful homeownership, sustainable homeownership for people, addressing the specific and critical needs in rental housing markets around the state. We've really found that the rental housing needs are very, very different from one part of the state to another, where in one place it may be a single room occupancy that's needed, another place it's for large families, and we try to have our tools be able to meet that full range of needs. Preventing and ending homelessness is one that is pretty self-explanatory. And then preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery, of doing that in a way that we can bring foreclosed properties back onto the tax rolls and being a good part of their communities. As I mentioned, our funding sources are varied. As you can see on this next slide, the blue segment of the pie is the largest, and this is where we access the capital markets, selling tax-exempt bonds or using various types of mortgage financing to provide single-family mortgages. Federal funds are primarily in the form of rental assistance for what are known usually as project-based Section 8 properties, where the actual contracts for rental assistance are attached to the building. Yes?
Commissioner, I'm sorry. Representative Mahoney is here now, so can you start from the beginning and start over again? Is that okay? I'm just kidding. So. Go ahead. Please continue.
Absolutely. So then we have what we call amortizing agency resources. This is actually the balance sheet of the agency, and we do use that to make certain loans that we can't sell tax-exempt bonds for, but are good market rate kind of performing loans. We use this, for example, to fund our home improvement lending program, which has been a longstanding program of the agency. You see that state appropriations, a very important segment of the pie, is just under 9% of the funding, and deferred agency resources is essentially agency earnings that are plowed back into programs each and every year is about 3%. Now, this is based on our 2014 affordable housing plan, which has already been completed. We run our program year from October 1 to September 30, and that was close to $800 million. We are already working on our 2015 affordable housing plan, which will have about $950 million of activity with a similar mix of resources. To show you the uses side of the equation, the next slide really shows the use of all funding sources. And you can see on the right side that the vast majority of dollars, not the vast majority, but half of them, really go to rental assistance. And again, that's primarily the rental assistance that we receive from the federal government, as well as the Housing Trust Fund and the Bridges Program, which I'll talk a little bit more in a minute. Home buyer programs are our next largest, and we help about 15,000 homeowners a year with either mortgages or home improvement loans. Non-capital resources to prevent and end homelessness is primarily our family homeless prevention program, which is funded with state appropriated dollars. Rental production, it might be surprising, although we do a large number of units, oftentimes we don't have to put a lot of money into each property to make them work. Home improvements, similar, and some other multiple use resources, which includes our challenge fund, which is quite well known. Oh, sir. Ryan's pointing out to me that my set skipped a slide. So back on slide number six, no state appropriations are used for agency administrative costs. So every dollar that's appropriated by the state is utilized for programs, not for administrative costs. And just to give you an idea of where most of the appropriated dollars go, about 56% go to households below $12,000 a year, which is the Minnesota Family Investment Program limit, and 61% go to families under $19,500, which is the poverty level for a family of three. Program delivery. How do we actually administer our programs? Nearly all assistance is provided through a network of private delivery partners. I know for people not familiar with the agency, that's a surprising factor. So, for example, our single-family mortgage programs are all delivered by community bankers. The community bankers are the ones that interface directly with borrowers. We then provide the funding to reimburse the lenders for those loans. Developers and property managers are those that own the properties, develop the properties, and make sure that they're run appropriately over time. So we happen to have a very good group of developers and owners throughout the state of Minnesota who are interested and willing to develop housing that includes affordable units. And for some of our programs, such as our rental assistance program, social service providers do that on a contract basis. We provide access to those dollars through a number of ways. Many of the programs, such as our mortgage program, is just on a constant pipeline basis. Some of our more scarce dollars, for example, our deferred sources for our rental program is really offered on a competitive basis once a year through what we call our consolidated RFP. And perhaps most important, because this is another misconception, Minnesota Housing does not own or operate any housing. So I want to emphasize that this is very much a private market set of programs that are developed, managed, originated by private parties, but funded through a variety of capital resources, including state appropriations. So how many people really are affected by this in any given year? So our last numbers from 2013, and these numbers will tie to to a book that you have at your places. This is our most recent program assessment. You will be receiving copies of our 2014 program assessment in February. We will be delivering those to all members of the committee. But this is the 2013 numbers. This was close to 63,000 households that were served, about 2,000 new affordable rental units or affordable units that were preserved, almost 3,000 mortgages, and in 2014 you'll see that we topped 3,000. And giving you a little bit of a preview, more than a quarter of those were to households of color, and you'll see in a minute why that is such an important statistic. Average income of home buyers is about $48,500, and that's well below the state median of $58,000, which is the median income. And that's a total of $782 million in total resources. So we have a range of programs at Minnesota Housing. We start with the people who are most stressed in their housing needs with homeless prevention. That's through our Family Homeless Prevention Program, where we prevent homelessness before it starts. The median income of the households served there is $9,000 a year. Our much preferred place to provide housing is in what we call supportive housing. This is affordable housing, that's permanent housing, that also is paired with supportive services dollars. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services and others. This is median household income served from $8,000 to $10,000. Affordable rental housing, this is maybe our most visible program, where we use a combination of federal tax credits, mortgage dollars from our balance sheet, deferred money from the state, and also housing infrastructure bonds. And there we're actually supporting the financing of new rental apartments or the rehabilitation of rental apartments. Median income of the households that actually live in those properties is somewhere between $8,000 and $22,000, depending on the targeting. And finally, our affordable home ownership is primarily first-time home buyers and home improvement loans. And there we're serving households anywhere from $20,000 up to $63,000. So I think you'll see that we're not just focused on the very low-income folks, we're not just focused on homeowners, but really a range across all of our programs.
Commissioner, if it's okay, if I could ask you a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
Maybe it gives you a chance to grab a drink of water, too. So with regards to the affordable housing, affordable home ownership aspect of this, as we saw during the sort of mortgage bubble real estate crisis, lending practices have dramatically tightened in the private sector. Can you talk about how Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has adjusted that lending practices, or are you piggybacking on the private sector? Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I know that buying a home now is it's a much more challenging environment from lending practice perspective compared to a pre-bubble.
Absolutely true, and thank you for that question. It's something that we work at literally every day. First of all, I want to say that the Minnesota housing portfolio, although it had higher delinquency and foreclosure rates during the recession than it had had historically, really our numbers, both on delinquencies and foreclosures, were much lower than the market as a whole, and that's for a very good reason. We always did fully documented loans. We always did 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. So we always made responsible mortgages. And the reason that delinquencies or foreclosures went up is, frankly, because a lot of people lost their jobs.
So you mean to tell me that by verifying what people made and not just trusting it on their application actually reduced the amount of falsified loans?
Shocking, yes.
Wow.
So we have been working, and one of the things that's important about having a housing finance agency that can do single family mortgages is we have access really to two programs that have helped us to reach more first-time home buyers during this very difficult time of lending. The first is that we are allowed to provide down payment assistance in connection with FHA, or Federal Housing Administration, mortgages. Other private sector lenders are not allowed to do that. And the reason that that's allowed, and it is a very specific policy on the part of FHA, is that housing finance agency mortgages do have a lower default rate even when they have down payment assistance with them. And so we've been able, through our programs, to provide people with mortgages that do not require a very, very large amount of money down. So we do typically do mortgages with 3% down, and much of the rest of the mortgage industry can require upwards of 20% down. So that's been one of the big ways that we've been able to really focus our resources on folks who have a steady income, have the ability to be successful homeowners during a time when underwriting standards have been very, very tight.
In that case, do the homeowners pay the PMI, or who?
Well, we actually do have access to a program that does not require private mortgage insurance that can be used. Also, as I think you know, there was an announcement 2 weeks ago that FHA is lowering its mortgage insurance premium. But where there is PMI involved, the borrower does pay that.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerdau. Curious on how you approach then their debt to income. Is that pretty much the same as would be in the private market?
Yes, and Representative Vogel, yes. In fact, we are bound by the requirements of the private market, whether it be FHA or Fannie Mae. So our debt-to-income ratios, our loan-to-value ratios, are exactly the same as the rest of the market. So it really does become important for us to kind of close that affordability gap through responsible down payment assistance.
Commissioner, what are the DTI ratios now for just the payment and then overall debt? What are the general guidelines they use now?
So it varies a little bit from program to program, so I don't want to give absolutes, but we're typically looking at what I think of as the back ratio, which is all debt to income, of about 38%.
So pretty much more conservative than it was just 5 years ago.
Absolutely. Probably down from about 45%.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it's a big difference, especially if your income is lower. That 7% can be a very big difference.
Absolutely. Please continue.
Okay, I want to talk just a little bit about our Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. When you do see our base budget coming before you in the future, you'll see that this is one of the largest programs funded by state appropriations. This is assistance that goes out to families to literally prevent them from becoming homeless. And what it's used for is relatively small grants that allow people to pay things like the first month's deposit, damage deposit for a rental property. And this program is administered in all 87 Minnesota counties. It serves a very, very low-income household, many, many families, and has really been instrumental in holding down the population that finds it necessary to go to an emergency shelter. And these are real folks with real stories. This was a family that used the program during the recession, where the dad had a job, lost it. They were evicted from rental housing, and we were able to use this program to help them move from a shelter into transitional housing for families. As I mentioned, supportive housing is where we provide typically rental assistance to families of very modest incomes that may have experienced homelessness and now are really trying to get stable, trying to get their lives back together so that they can maybe deal with health issues, maybe deal with not having a job and needing some job training. And one of the important factors of supportive housing is really getting stable housing for kids. one of the things that I know you hear about in your education discussions is just how important it is for kids when they're in school not to have to move in order for them to be successful. We also support a lot of people with disabilities. One of the things you'll see when we talk about homelessness is a very large percentage of people who experience homelessness do have some sort of physical or mental disability, problems with drug or alcohol, and it is very much a part of solving the homelessness issue. I'll just skip to the next one. We've moved then to affordable rental housing, and this is a fairly visible program, and you'll see in a minute that it is located literally all over the state. We have a range of programs. One of the most important that we use is the federal low-income housing tax credit program, which we receive an allocation of tax credits every year that really is at the core of the federal assistance programs that are available for making housing permanently affordable. We can combine that with state appropriations. And in this program, we have some fairly wide parameters and can really assist renters up to incomes of about $58,000 a year. So what that means is we really do a fair number of projects that could be defined as workforce housing. I know you're going to hear a lot more about that later in the testimony today. And we have, in fact, worked in a number of communities where there is a shortage of affordable housing to do workforce housing. We also, within our affordable rental program, really spend a fair amount of effort on preserving existing federally assisted housing. Our program is called the PARAF program. That means Preservation Affordable Rental Funding, and it's used for preservation across the state. And just to give you an idea of how many units there are throughout the state, there are about 30,000 project-based Section 8. Many of them are for elderly people. Many of you who are from greater Minnesota will know exactly which building I'm talking about in downtown County Seat that will house many of the people who are either elderly or disabled in your communities. And what we found over the years is that by spending $1 of state investment to make sure that these buildings stay good and healthy and good places to live preserves $4 in ongoing federal rental assistance. So for many years, this legislature has seen this as a good investment. I won't spend a lot of time on the next three slides, but I'll leave them for your perusal. The first slide just shows you where the project-based Section 8 and rural development projects are. Rural development are similar to project-based Section 8, just a different initial funding source. Developments with federal housing tax credits, and then the third variety of housing, which this legislature has chosen to make some capital investments in, is public housing, which is managed by public entities throughout the state. Finally, we get to affordable home ownership. I've talked quite a bit about this. In our 2014 program year, we made over $400 million of mortgages available to serve nearly 3,000 households. The next slide is a typical home buyer, a single mother living in greater Minnesota, working as a registered nurse, getting both a mortgage and a down payment assistance loan to afford her first house. The next program that I want to talk about is one that you'll see in our budgets, and that's our rehabilitation loan program. This is a program that has been funded consistently since 1976, and I know that because early in my career I worked at Minnesota Housing, and I was hired when this program was first funded by the legislature in 1976.
You started working there when you were 5 years old?
Yeah, I think so. I left for a long period of time and came back 4 years ago. But this is an amazing program that serves very low-income homeowners. 14,000 is our typical annual income for those homeowners. A third of those homeowners are seniors who are really just trying to stay in their house and have things like needs like accessibility improvements, maybe a new roof, maybe a new furnace, in order for them to be able to stay there. And about a quarter of those households have a member that has a disability. Really important program that doesn't get a lot of airtime, and I wanted to highlight that one for you. And more than half of the residents that are served by that program live in Greater Minnesota. So what are some of the things that we see as the challenges that we'll be discussing with you over the next several months? The homeownership gap is one that is of great concern to us. The good news is that Minnesota has the third highest homeownership rate in the nation, something that we can and should be very proud of. But we also have the third worst disparity in homeownership rates between whites and households of color. And particularly as we've welcomed many immigrant families, I know that as we have meetings with communities in southern Minnesota, a lot of the agricultural processors, this is particularly an issue. We can show you on the slide just how graphically this is the case. So at the top, we have the black line, which is the white non-Hispanic homeownership rate, an amazing 76%, down a little bit from the height in 2006 of almost 80%, but still a very, very high level. Three out of every four families in Minnesota own their home, which is amazing. But then we see the bottom line, the blue line, households of color, where we sit at only 40%. Again, about 5% worse than it was at the height of the lending craze. But we would like to bring those two lines really closer together. Some of the things that we do within Minnesota Housing to make sure that that happens is every year we set a goal for ourselves and we measure ourselves against that goal of how many households of color we're serving. And this past year, we set a goal of 22%, and we actually exceeded that goal by really tailoring some of our programs in a way that would meet some of the specific needs that we've noticed within our data are experienced by households of color. And that's compared to the overall market that serves only 10% households of color. So that's the main mortgage market. We also recently started a pilot program using some dollars from our balance sheet for a pilot program that will allow us to make some of those mortgages that are maybe just not quite at the point where they can meet the federal mortgage standards, but they're very, very close. And we think with some seasoning on our balance sheet that they will one day be able to go to some of those more national funding sources. The next issue we see is that, unfortunately, the number of Minnesotans that pay too much for housing is staying stubbornly high. So 28% of Minnesotans, 600,000 households, pay more than 30% of their income for housing. That declined from 30% in 2013, but it's largely because things have improved for homeowners. And if we could look at the next slide, you'll see that the cost-burdened households among renters is nearly 50%, and in fact was 50% in 2009 through 11. With homeowners, that's down around 21%. So you can see between 2011 and 2013, you can really see the really positive impact for homeowners of lower interest rates and the ability to refinance mortgages. That's it's been a huge benefit for homeowners in Minnesota. But the same kind of benefit was not felt by renters because there was a very slow period where not many rental properties were built. And so we have that tight vacancy rate and that increasing affordability problem for renters.
Commissioner, what was the definition of cost burden? Was it the 30% threshold?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
If we go back for just a minute to the previous slide, we see that more than 250,000 lower-income renters, that's below 50% of median, are cost-burdened. And compared to that, over the 40 years that Minnesota Housing has been in place, we only have about 100,000 units where the rents are, you know, fixed at an affordable level. So we have a mismatch between people who are low income, who are renting, and the number of affordable units that we have. So I just like to try to keep that in perspective for you. I know, you know, we won't be able to solve all the problems of the world, but I like to have you have a sense of how big the gap is in some of these areas. And then finally, we're going to talk about too many Minnesotans being homeless. I mentioned that on any given night, 8 to 10,000 Minnesotans are homeless, and almost half of those people are children and youth. Half are children and youth. And what that means is that those are kids who are trying to learn, trying to go to school when they don't have a home. And the next bullet, I think, is the one that I want you to be a little bit hopeful about, in contrast to what I just said about homeless families. And that is the state of Minnesota in 2006, approximately, really focused on chronic homelessness and veterans homelessness. And as the next slide will show you, where we focus our attention and really try to solve a problem, we actually can make progress. So you see where we were in 2009 with chronic homelessness and veterans homelessness. Many of the resources that have been appropriated by this legislature have been focused on those populations, and we really have made a significant dent in homelessness. Unfortunately, during the same period, the number of families and children and youth that have become homeless has gone up. So what you'll see is that we will be shifting our focus not away from chronic homelessness and veterans homelessness, but really to be more inclusive to also address the needs of homeless families. One thing I will say is that the Interagency Council on Homelessness, which I co-chair with Commissioner Jessen from DHS, has set a goal of ending veterans homelessness literally by the end of this year. We are sub 300 veterans that are homeless right now, and we really think we can make a big dent in that number by the end of this year. New investments in supportive housing. Those of you who were here last year know that you included an unprecedented capital investment in support in housing last year, and that allowed us to support the largest number of new supportive housing units financed by the state at almost 700 units that we're able to tie with supportive services. Finally, our impact. We really think, and we hope you share this belief, that stable, affordable, high-quality housing is a platform for success, no matter who you are, throughout the state of Minnesota. And we think that our efforts at housing, and we really work very hard to make these connections, can really support some key state priorities, whether that be education, getting stable homes for kids so that they can actually learn while they're in school, jobs and workforce development, whether it's supporting people who need a little help while they're getting job training, or whether it's providing housing in our greater Minnesota communities for workforce, and really better governments. So things like working with the Department of Corrections to make sure that when people exit our corrections facility, they actually can find a place to live. So with that, thank you for your attention. And if there are any other questions, we'd be happy to take those now or later.
Commissioner McEdwards, just a couple of minutes for questions, if that's okay. So Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Thingetherl, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I'm curious, on one of your last slides talking about veterans, you said we have roughly or just under 300 veterans. I'm curious to know, how do you actually identify the individuals? What's the mechanism that you use to identify those individuals?
That's a really great question and a great opportunity for you to tell for me to tell you about our new efforts. So the 300 number comes from what we call the point in time count, which is an annual census that's done every January to determine what the number of homeless people is. But with regard to veterans, we just kicked off in December a new effort, which is a voluntary veterans registry, which, if the veterans are willing, will register people by name within that veterans registry that are homeless and will allow us to more tailor the exact solutions that are needed for that veteran to be to no longer be homeless, whether it's health care, whether it's getting them aligned with the benefits that they've earned, whether it's getting them aligned with available housing resources. And that's being spearheaded by our Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And there's actually a position that's been funded to focus specifically on that effort.
Representative Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, then, this is the known number, so it could actually be different than that. So from the time that you actually identify a veteran that is in need of a place to live, a home, how long does it take for that process to get from point A to being in a home?
Representative Fabian, that's a question that I can't answer right now. We are just at the beginning of this veteran-by-veteran approach, and I understand from talking to the person who's coordinating that program that they have just had a session just this week on the first 20 veterans that registered with the homeless registry, and they determined that 18 of them will be immediately placeable into housing. So hopefully I'll be able to come back to you about a month from now and give you a report on how we did.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius, you get the last question. No pressure.
We'll be good.
This is a new area for me, so I just want to make sure I understand. You said you don't own and operate any housing, but I do get the sense that you do have an ongoing obligation because we give subsidies for renting. And I got that right? Okay, so my question is, for those ongoing expenses for the taxpayer, for future taxpayers, or for the person who now is in a home, how do we make sure that those expenses, like for heating, I'm particularly thinking about, are as absolutely small as they possibly can be?
Commissioner.
Representative Wagenius, it's a complicated question. What I would answer it a little bit globally by saying that we do allocate staff, a fair amount of staff, to what I would call asset management. So there are people who interact with all of the rental property owners and make sure that those buildings are continuing to operate in a way that is effective and efficient. And also our portfolio management for our single family mortgages. We monitor it very closely, and we interact with families when there's the slightest hint of that they might be having some financial problems. In terms of your question about keeping operating costs low, we have had a pilot program ongoing with our rental properties for the last 2 years, which is a partnership with Xcel Energy and a group called that uses a program called Energy Scorecard, and we're providing that information to property owners on their own buildings so that they can make investment decisions about good energy conserving improvements that can be made. Also, with with our home ownership program. We have a joint effort with the Department of Commerce right now that provides a lower interest rate on our home improvement loans for improvements that are for energy conservation.
Representative Guinness, if you could quickly go ahead and ask your follow-up question, but we do have four other testifiers, and one of them is Dan Dorman, and so I am very eager, the chair is very eager to hear from former Representative Dorman. So.
Well, then I won't make a question. I'll just make a comment. I don't see the incentives here that are built in for keeping those expensive, particularly for heating, which is a big expense in Minnesota, as low as possible, and maybe we can have some conversation about that later.
Well, the benefit of efficiency is it's efficient. So, thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate you coming by. Don't be a stranger. Maybe we'll see you when the governor's budget comes out next week. You come by and provide an update. So it's great to see you, and congratulations to you and Mr. Bomtrag, right?
Bomtrag.
Thank
you.
Close enough.
Thank you so much for your attention.
So we'll see you. Thank you. Mr. Hansen, Warren Hansen, you're next. And then Patrick Hines is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund.
And I goofed up. It's Rick Goodman's on deck, not Patrick Kynes. I'm sorry. Apparently three is after two, and I should know that. So we have you down for about 10 minutes. Is that right, sir?
Yes.
Okay.
And here, I can't tell which one.
While we set that up, I'll just give you a little background here. Again, my name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and thank you so much for allowing time for me to testify today. I'm really here on behalf of the Homes for All organization or coalition, which is a coalition of 150 housing organizations and civic and community groups from around the state who are concerned about affordable housing in every aspect, everything from permanent supportive housing for the homeless to workforce housing and everything in between. I just wanted to also mention that Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, for your information, was founded in 1996 by McKnight Foundation and Blandon Foundation. And the reason I mention that is I think it's useful and important to realize that philanthropy has been at the table with the state, with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, with the legislature, with the governor, making investments and contributions for the production and preservation of affordable housing for approximately 30 years. And in fact, we are a partner with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency in what's called the Super RFP, their Super Request for Proposal, which is the annual process by which the state makes its decisions about which projects to fund and finance and where, based on an objective set of points and criteria. And Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, the Family Housing Fund, and other organizations participate in this cooperative process, which is really a national model for a kind of a collaborative, well-aligned public-private decision-making process where philanthropy is a partner with state government. Also, I wanted to point out the magnitude of the investments that the foundation community has made into affordable housing in Minnesota. And Minnesota is extremely rare and fortunate to have had these kind of investments. To date, McKnight Foundation and Blandon Foundation and other foundations have provided about $130 million to affordable housing through Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and $180 million. And over $250 million through the Family Housing Fund in the Twin Cities. So we're getting close to $500 million of philanthropic and charitable dollars that are partnering with the state to make these investments that you're considering go as far as they can. And we see ourselves as a partner with the state, and we see ourselves as being a partner in the long term going forward. The The way the Homes for All Coalition has formed is also fairly unique. Approximately 4 or 5 years ago, if you were in the legislature, you were probably approached by a variety, a plethora of housing organizations who were interested in particular programs and funding agendas. And about 4 years ago, that group of housing organizations from around the state, this includes the developers that build the affordable housing, a lot of housing and redevelopment authorities, local government, and so forth, got together and came up with a unified agenda. And that's what you see in front of you today. And the ask that the Homes for All agenda is looking for is an increase to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's budget of $19 million for Minnesota Housing, and a complementary amount for Department of Human Services for various services that are associated with affordable housing and are necessary for the stability of a lot of families that are homeless and need to get into permanent supportive housing with services, or maybe need services in their current housing to remain stable. So for that ask, there are several goals that the Homes for All Coalition are hoping to advance, and know that if these funds are provided, that there will in fact be progress in these areas. And the commissioner talked about several of these, if not all of them. But let me just go through a few of them. This increase of $19 million above the base would very much advance the agenda to address housing shortages in areas of economic growth and economic vitality, particularly in greater Minnesota. And it would expand housing options specifically for a growing workforce, as the commissioner said, for homeless vets, which we hope to fully house by the end of 2015, if not shortly thereafter, and for families with children and other underserved populations. And interestingly, it's been proven now that in many cases, if we reduce homelessness, if we end homelessness for certain chronic persons and families, what we're actually going to do is save public dollars. It'll cost less, and we will save local and state public dollars that would otherwise be spent for emergency services and social services and so forth, if we can stably house individuals and families that are experiencing homelessness and get them off the street and out of the costly emergency service reliance. And also, I think it's well recognized now through a lot of studies that stable housing improves the educational achievement potential for children and youth, and by providing safe and stable housing, we are actually helping them become better employable citizens in the future and succeed at work as well as in school.
Mr. Hansen, I don't mean to rush it. We got about 2 minutes before we go to our next speaker, and I know Representative Mahoney has a question as well. So
okay. Let me just skip this because the commissioner talked about the statewide housing burden, and talk about the Homes for All agenda. I think you have a handout, and I'll just quickly talk about these various components of the, and it's too hard to read up here, but in your handout you'll see a table that looks like that. And basically, if you look at the challenge program, Homes for All is looking for a $4.75 million increase that will create an estimated 236 units of affordable housing that must remain affordable for 20 years. Another area on that list is the capacity building grant-making activity of $250,000, which would go to nonprofit developers to help them improve their operations and expand their capacity. If you look at the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, that is a $4 million request that would cost only about $827 per household to help families transition out of homelessness and into stable housing. And the monthly rental assistance program that the commissioner mentioned earlier would be increased according to this request by $1.5 million for the Bridges program. And there's a couple of pilots here for homeless and highly mobile families, $2 million for that to help address the people that are very highly mobile and families with children, to help pilot a program that would demonstrate how to effectively move those people into stable housing. This is actually part of the Housing Trust Fund line item in that budget. And then funds for owner-occupied rehab of single-family homes of $1 million. And those are my comments. I would just close by saying that, again, philanthropy, charitable foundations, McKnight Foundation, Blandon Foundation, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Family Housing Fund, have been really strong partners with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We've been investing partnering with the state to produce more affordable housing, including workforce housing and housing for the homeless, for 30 years, and we look forward to an ongoing partnership.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Representative Mahoney, and then Mr. Goodman, if you want to begin coming down to the table. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you highlighted the fact that philanthropic organizations are substantially funding housing issues. Specifically, you said $180 million in what I thought you said was Greater Minnesota and $250 million in the metro region.
Yes.
There's been a huge focus on Greater Minnesota housing. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what part of that you could do it for both, actually, but what part of the $180 million of philanthropic giving was for workforce housing, and what percentage or what part was for low-income homeless in Greater Minnesota?
I can't give you an exact amount, but for the charitable dollars, I would just say that in the early days of our existence, under the previous administration, Arnie Carlson's to be specific, there was a huge demand for workforce housing, and we worked with employers throughout the state, and I can give you this manual here, which lists employers that we have worked with throughout the state who came to the table to with $20 million, Mayo Clinic, 100 businesses in the Olmsted County area, Schwann's, Hormel, Genio, and today Polaris, Marvin Windows, and DigiKey, and others that are coming to the table with resources to help create workforce housing in partnership with their local community and with Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and when those are tax credit projects with the state housing finance agency. So there was a huge surge of investment in workforce housing in the mid to late 90s, and when the economy was very hot. The economy is heating up again, thankfully, and we're looking now for partnerships with employers, and we're using our resources to leverage their interest and investment in workforce housing.
And Mr. Chair, just quickly, is there any way you could kind of figure out that particular question or an answer to that particular question? Because it even for a Democrat, I'm a big supporter of capitalism, and it seems kind of odd that workforce has to rely on charity.
I agree. I would say that one way to think about this that I find very helpful,
well,
to your point,
employers aren't paying enough, that there's a wage gap. That's okay.
Mr. Hansen, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you coming in today. Mr. Goodman, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rick Goodman, Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. I'm the chief executive officer. I'll give you a little bit of, there's a handout going around, what I'll be testifying on is the need to work on this workforce housing need. The Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership is a private nonprofit. We're a community development corporation. We develop a lot of housing. We were formed in 1992, right after the farm crisis, to really support economic development and job growth in southwestern Minnesota. We have developed or preserved over 5,000 housing units across southern and western Minnesota. The handout shows on the third page our areas of operation, and at this point we own and operate 1,640 rental units in 44 communities or housing developments across primarily southern Minnesota. And as has been mentioned many times before, the economy is heating up. Greater Minnesota is thriving, and it's extremely frustrating out there. There is a huge demand for housing. We have communities with 0% functional vacancy rates, Worthington being one of them, over 350 rental units of demand, and the private sector can't operate. Within my question from Representative Mahoney is why. It's there's no real simple answer. It is a part of it is driven by the financial markets. Part of it's driven by depressed rental rates. Part of it's driven by the condition of the housing, and it the way it's functioning is that, and I do have a example of this on the last page, is that in many of our communities the prevailing rents are around $600 to $700 a month for a two-bedroom unit. In order to create new product, the rents need to be between $1,200 and $1,300 a month. The issue is that when you're dealing with a financial institution, you're dealing with an investor, they commission market studies and will base the rents that can be achieved on what's already out there. Most of the comparable housing units are already are aging. There's been no production, new production other than production through low-income housing tax credits, which is a great program and serves the lower end of the workforce, but tends to restrain rents because those rents are income restricted or restricted by regulation. So recently I've been working with AGCO in Jackson. AGCO is putting $220,000 into a housing project. We're developing 48 units. We did a market study that showed, based on workforce incomes, based on the median income of the community, the rents could actually be about $150 to $180 over what the prevailing rent was. We set our rents at that level. The investor came in, did a market study, and pushed them right back down to a to be comparable to a project we developed 16 years before. It's a low-income housing tax credit model, and created a $380,000 financial gap for the project, which we're now filling with the help of Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. We've also been working, doing a lot of work with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Minnesota Housing Partnership, on looking at why the private sector can't respond when you have demand of hundreds of units across the state of Minnesota. So we've run various models and looked at what are the prevailing rents, what are the wages, what could be supported based on those wages and those rents within the community, and why isn't it happening? And it's coming back to this whole cycle of appraised values, no comparables, and that we can't, that when you look at this and you put the project together, you shove down the rents, and we're having enormous financial gaps. So if you look at the last page of my handout, which I ran using Jackson numbers. Then we used existing tax increment financing regulations, which require 20% of the units to be at 50% area median income or 40% at 60%. We ran this at 20% of the units being at 50%. We looked at a 41-unit project. We have a comparable which is a photograph on the last page of a project that was developed in Thief River Falls several years ago, and used those construction numbers and inflated them based on over the last 3 years. So we're looking at rents, 50% rents at $597 for a one-bedroom, $717 for a two-bedroom, $828 for a three-bedroom. Then we looked at what would be affordable under the workforce in Jackson, and this is from data that's been derived from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency of $699, $840, and $969. We then looked at how much debt that would be supported based on an appraisal on net operating income, so an income-based appraisal. The debt would be $1.8 million. We looked at the other debt capacity would be provided by the higher rent of $700,000. So we get to a debt capacity of $2.5 million. The total development cost for this project, if you look at the last page, is $4.8 million. We have a subsidy need of $2.3 million to make this project work. We then identified where we came up with the costs for the development, acquisition costs, construction, environmental soft costs, those sorts of things, which are pretty typical on a development, and came up with $118,500 per unit for a walk-up type of development. $118,500 is difficult to achieve, so that's very much on the affordable side as far as development costs are concerned. So recently, 2 weeks ago, I had a meeting with Redwood Falls, and Redwood Falls says, we would like you to develop around 40 units for us. They've been working with a private sector developer for 2 years, got nowhere. They said to me, we will give you the land that's already improved. We will give you tax increment financing. We will also give you $200,000. I pulled out this model and said, this is why I can't do it. The amount of subsidy that I can get from the community is too low to deal with the investment gap that's caused by typical underwriting in a multifamily development project, regardless of any type of other subsidy. And tax increment financing.
Sorry, this seems like an incredibly correctable problem. I remember you and I went through this office, yes, in my office before. So what is it what is the response from the investment community outside of this is standard practice? Because it just doesn't make any sense. What is their response to this?
It's about risk mitigation. So when you're doing a market analysis, you're looking at what's actually operating in the community, and the rents are so depressed that they're not looking at how high, what's the median income or what the wage rates are. They're looking at what's actually going on in the community. We've had no new production of housing. There are no comparables. There's no way really to test the market unless we have, as we've talked about with the commissioner, is there some type of other subsidy or is there some other type of mission-oriented investment that can come in that will accept a higher risk and maybe a lower return. So what's happening with the funds that are available for investment, they're migrating to bigger markets. They're going to the Twin Cities. They're going to North Dakota. They're going to Sioux Falls. They're going to Omaha. They're going anywhere but greater Minnesota. That's what's so frustrating about this problem. It is correctable.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just mean, the inputs for they're using for their decision-making are wrong. I mean, do they know this or not?
The other issue is that in order for a typical project to work, if you're looking at debt to equity and not having any other type of subsidy, you're generally looking at 75% debt to 25% equity or 80% to 20%, depending on how strong the balance sheet is of the developer. In greater Minnesota, we need $1,200 rents. When you look at this and you look at what are the wage rates, there is a gap. But we believe that if we can push that up, we definitely can impact the amount of subsidy that's necessary to respond to this project in a market-oriented way. We're still going to need some type of subsidy. That's why we're coming forward and asking the legislature for some assistance with this. We're working now with, I've met with Schwann's, I've met with Genio recently, Phi Industry, working with AGCO. I've got a meeting with the chamber a couple weeks. I've met with over 15 communities from Dodge Center to Mankato, to North Mankato, to St. Peter, to Worthington, to Redwood Falls, to Wilmer, to Marshall, you name it, because the housing is getting so tight. The employers are saying, we cannot expand. We have employers threatening to leave, like FI Industry, unless something is done, because they are absolutely, totally frustrated that they have done a good job. They have invested in their plants. They are hiring thousands of people. The state of Minnesota and local communities have made significant investments to drive economic development and job growth. And there is nowhere to house people. AGCO had an experience about a year ago. They imported 65 welders from Indiana. They worked in the community for a month, 2 months, and could not find housing and went back to Indiana. This is not uncommon. And this has been going on for a long time. Before the downturn, we were trying to respond to this. And we were able to do that using essential function bonds to develop housing earlier. But as the cost of construction has risen, we need more subsidy. And that, it was mentioned earlier, construction costs have gone up dramatically and are part of the problem. But they're not all the problem. So at the last bottom of the second page, I have some solutions that we're recommending. We've been working with the Greater Minnesota Partnership, League of Minnesota Cities, also to try to shape what we think would be effective in trying to respond to this issue. And I think one of the problems we're having is, how do we define workforce housing?
So just go ahead and finish up. I didn't want to cut you off.
Yeah, and essentially, I think we need to cap that somehow and say, what part of the continuum of workforce housing does the state need to intervene in?
And members, we have multiple members with questions. We have two other testifiers. What we're going to do is we're going to hear from the other two testifiers, and then we'll circle back with members for individual questions. And as always, if we run out of time, members can always submit their questions in writing to the testifier, and the testifier can reply back so that all members of the committee have that answer. But thank you very much for
your time.
Yep. Next, we have Mr. Hines from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I have notes here, and I've written Rick's name next to many of them because he did an excellent job covering a lot of the details on why this issue is important and why it needs state assistance. I'll try not to go over the same ground that Rick did, but when he left the table, the question was posed, how do we define workforce housing? And from the perspective of the League of Minnesota Cities, and when I hear from my member cities, they're talking about market rate housing that's necessary to accommodate job growth. So you're looking at communities with low vacancy rates, low unemployment, and a tight labor market. You're looking at very low rental rates, like Mr. Goodman was discussing, which makes it very hard to finance these projects. And our cities have repeatedly told the League that what they're really trying to get is true market rate housing, not trying to develop a mixed use where you have some of the units are subject to affordable rental caps or income caps, while some of the units are market rate. They want to develop true market rate housing so that companies like Polaris, who have been in communities for many years and want to expand, can do that. I think when you talk about it that way, the obvious question, and it's been asked already, if there's such high demand for the units, why aren't they getting built? And since I'm not a housing expert, I will take a shot at trying to define it in a much less complicated way. And I think it boils down to the fact that the cost of building market rate housing in Greater Minnesota far exceeds the amount of money that's available to finance the construction. So even if you have willing developers and a community that wants to grow, they have great difficulty financing the construction. And I'll use the city of Roseau as an example. Last year, the legislature appropriated $2 million to DEED for a workforce housing pilot program, and cities in Roseau and Pennington counties were eligible. And The amount of money was capped at 10% of the project cost.
That was called college student housing.
No, I think that was a different appropriation, Representative Mahoney. But at any rate, so the city of Roseau is in the process of helping to finance a 30-unit rental apartment building. They broke ground in September. The cost of that project is approximately $3.2 million for 30 units. When the appraisal came back for that project, the appraised value was $2.15 million. So you can see, before you've even put a shovel in the ground, you've got a project that's underwater, which makes it unlikely for most developers to want to undertake that project. And as was stated earlier, a bank can only loan up to 80% of the appraised value of a project. So the project cost is $3.27 million. The bank loan can only go up to $1.7 million. So you have $1.5 million, which need to be financed somehow. And unlike affordable housing, there aren't any programs available from the state to help finance market rate housing. And local units of government can't use tax increment financing unless they meet the affordable housing income limits. So you're looking at a very difficult situation for a city like Roseau to cobble together financing to build these units, which are in demand. And so the way Roseau got it done was by putting a lot of local money into the project. Roseau has a $60,000 0% deferred loan for the land acquisition costs. They have an additional $400,000 deferred 30-year mortgage on this project to help finance it. And they have $160,000, which is a more traditional 3.5% 30-year loan on that project. In addition, a third-party lender, Midwest Minnesota Development Corporation, loaned $520,000 to the project. That amount is secured by a separate property that's owned by the developer, just to get that money involved. And then the deed grant filled an additional, or the remaining $325,000. So you can see in that project, it required an enormous amount of money from the local community in order to get it off the ground. And the reason has to do precisely with what Mr. Goodman described. The average rent in Roseau is $650. That's simply not enough to cash flow a project, and the financing problems cascade from there. So I think what we learned from Roseau is that it's possible to do these projects, but it's very difficult. Roseau was lucky in that it had available cash on hand to finance this one project. It's unlikely it would have that much cash to finance any other. They had a local developer who was really interested in developing in Roseau. It wasn't a developer who wanted to find a project somewhere to develop. He wanted to be in Roseau and push this issue to make sure it got done. So it's very hard to see how we replicate this statewide without some additional state money. And so what the League has proposed, and we brought legislation with Representative Fabian last year and we'll do so again, is to expand that pilot program so that it's statewide, so that communities with a demonstrated need like Roseau or Perham or Worthington can access grant money to help close the financing gap. We'd also like to see expanded use of tax increment financing for selected communities that have this demonstrated need so that they can put together a financing package at the local level for this market rate workforce housing. I hope I didn't run through too fast. I know we're short on time.
No, that was great. Actually, Mr. Hines, that was really well done. And we've got a few folks who want to ask some questions. We're going to bring up Mr. Dorman if we could now, and we'll save the other questions for later. But thank you so much for that. And right now, excuse me, when Mr. Dorman gets set up here, we've got Representative Fabian, Wagenius, Mahoney, and Scott that are on the list for asking questions. So we will get to you right after that. So
Welcome, Mr. Dorman, and thank you so much for being here from Greater Minnesota Partnership.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm happy to be here on behalf of the Greater Minnesota Partnership and its over 90 members that come from across the state. The organization is made up of private businesses, EDAs, chambers of commerce, some nonprofits, some minuscule schools. So we have a pretty good broad representation of members and board. And I would say that of the issues that we hear most about in throughout the state is job training and workforce housing, and they sometimes travel together. But in this case, we're talking about workforce housing. I won't go over the same items that Mr. Goodman and Mr. Hines have presented because they're right on target. There is something wrong in the market. It is not functioning as we'd like it to in Greater Minnesota. And what we have being jacketed and will hopefully be back to talk to you about is a bill that has a market-based solution, which is a tax credit-based solution, patterning it a little bit off of things like the Angel Investor Tax Credit. How do we create an incentive for development in these areas? And we think that's important. And so rather than reinvent the wheel, what we have done is we've taken a look at what's worked in other states. Minnesota's not alone with this problem. We find it throughout, particularly the Midwest, where there is not a shortage of workforce housing. And so we looked at primarily North Dakota and Iowa. They have a couple different programs, but it's to create a incentive for whether it's the Polaris or a similar company to invest in a project, or for a local group of individuals to get together and say, hey, I care about my community. I may not be large enough to need 40 units on my own, but I want to invest in my community. And so it will be restricted to those within a 20 or 30-mile area that want to pool their dollars together to stimulate that economy and stimulate that investment. But it is critical. It's not low income. It is workforce. It's my hometown of Albert Lea, we hear about it from the school district, the hospital, and others saying, you know, we've got a problem attracting people to fill vacant jobs because of the existing housing stock. So it's a problem that we need to address. Also a problem that has been out there for a long time. I thought about this and what I was going to say to you today. And prior to being in the legislature, I was first elected in 1998. I was involved in a local nonprofit that was working on essentially workforce housing in the Albert Lea area in the early 90s. Nothing has really changed. A lot of people have talked about it. I think that almost every year people have talked about, gee, we need to do something for workforce housing. We need to figure this out. We need to get these jobs filled. We're hopeful that bringing a lot of ideas forward, that this year will be the year we take some action and that we do something meaningful in this area of workforce housing in Greater Minnesota. So that's our proposal. We also are going to support the League TIF initiative. We actually think it should be a little broader. That might be the only difference. TIF, by and large, are local dollars, so if a community wants to invest their dollars into this, I'm not sure why there's the level of angst there is by some folks in the legislature. If we believe in local control, let the locals control their destiny. But in and of itself, TIF generally isn't going to be enough of an incentive in order to get the market working, but it is an important tool. So we do support that, and we support the extension of the pilot program statewide. We think that would be beneficial as well, Mr. Chair. So I know you're running out of time. You have several questions. So I just provided that quick overview of what we'll be coming forward with, a market-based approach, and we hope to be back before you with that. But we'd be happy to stand for any questions that you may have.
Well, thank you. Is it Representative Dorman, Mr. Dorman?
Dan.
Port Authority Dorman?
I've been called a lot of things.
You do represent him.
Some of it's hyphenated, some of it isn't.
Well, why don't we have Mr. Hines and Mr. Goodman come up to the table just so we can try to get through a couple of members' questions here. First, and thank you, Mr. Dorman, for your testimony. We'll start with Representative Fabian, then Wagenius, then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you can see, this is a problem with lots of spokes in the wheel in my part of the state. And I just want to make a comment. You know, sometimes there's the perception out there that the employers don't have any skin in the game in some of these things. And really nothing could be further from the truth. I don't want to take a lot of time. We can get into that at another time. But our local communities and our local employers have a tremendous amount of skin invested in this situation. So And you know, and to Representative Mahoney, we've talked about this last year, the comment about, well, if they would just pay more in wages, yeah, in theory that works, but the reality is that in the major employers forum that I have in my district that employ over 2,000 people each, starting wages, hourly wages at those facilities are higher than the average hourly wage in all of rural Minnesota. So think about that for a minute. I mean, by about $1.50 to $2. The starting wage at those four large employers is higher than the average hourly wage throughout rural Minnesota, according to the numbers that I've been given by Deed. So there's a whole bunch of things involved here. And to the TIF, I just have to comment, you know, last year when I brought the bill forward with the help of the League, or actually they brought it forward with my help, I'm not exactly sure of the minutia there, but I got a call from a publication here in the metro area, and near the end of the conversation about the TIF bill, the reporter asked me and said, well, Dan, aren't you worried about your local officials, you know, using this TIF authority to maybe go off and just create some luxury housing? And I asked, I said, well, have you ever been to Rosa or Greenbush? And he said, well, no, I haven't. And I said, well, that's obvious, yeah. You know, because, number one, our local officials would never do that. And if we do build something luxurious, we catch walleyes out of it in the wintertime, or we shoot deer out of it in the fall. So, anyway, my question was for Mr. Hansen, and then I have one for Mr. Hines. On the handout that you have, the single family rehab, I did a little quick math. You're asking for $6.5 million. That's 50 additional households. That's $130,000 per household. And in the challenge fund, you got 236 units, and that's $127,000 per unit. It costs more to rehab something than it does to build new.
It often does, Mr. Chair and Representative. It's not uncommon for rehab to involve, you know, a significant amount of demolition and even environmental issues, and it can be more to do rehab.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of questions in my area, and Representative Gunther asked me a short time ago about the Challenge Grant Fund. And our community tried for I don't know how many years. I don't know if Commissioner Tingerthal is still here, but we tried to use that challenge grant, and it didn't work. So, Mr. Hines, maybe you could help me elaborate on why the challenge grant doesn't work to develop workforce housing.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I think the issue goes to, again, how we define workforce housing and what our cities are looking to build. And I have many emails from economic developers and cities throughout the state saying we're not trying to develop affordable housing, so we can't use TIF, we can't use the challenge grants because they come with income restrictions on at least a percentage of the units. And what they are saying is we want jobs where a two-earner family will earn in excess of what the income limits are. And so in order to build those units, you can't use MHFA challenge grant, you can't use affordable housing TIFs, you can't use federal tax credits. And that's where we find the need, at least for this. And that's not to say there's no need for affordable housing in greater Minnesota. We don't view this as mutually exclusive. We think there are two different issues, and we think there need to be two separate solutions. So we've asked for money to be not tied to income.
No. We'll go to Wagenius, then Mahoney.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for being here, and thanks for letting me ask a question. Up until
my good friend.
Yes. Spoke. I thought there was an elephant that had skated around Representative Mahoney and sat in the middle of the room, and that was wages. But Rosa was an outlier on the upside. We haven't talked about the downside. And one of the ways we can look at wages, and we need to, is look at the free and reduced lunches of Southwest, for example. And I actually had a run done 2 years ago, so it's a bit out of date. But in Worthington, the elementary school, 72% free and reduced lunch. In the middle school, it's 60-some percent. Austin's way up there, too. So these are communities that do the production of our food, where the people producing the food don't have enough money to feed their children. Well, of course, they don't have money for housing then. So we got to talk about this wage thing and not ignore it. So until we can have an honest discussion about the wages, and perhaps, Mr. Chair, if you would like to have me have the free and reduced lunch run updated. Mine is 2 years old. Tim Strom did it. But I'm just, some of the numbers are just astounding. Austin Public Schools, 67, 65, 65, 62% free and reduced lunch. And just for you all who haven't dealt with these numbers before, I am a Minneapolis legislator, so I should have the poor schools. I don't have that high free and reduced lunch in my schools in my district. We need to talk about this.
Thank you, Representative McGinnis. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions, so I'll be as quick as I possibly can. I don't care who answers this one. Will someone tell me, you, because you brought it up, what is the limit on MFHA housing income? I mean, you keep talking about market rate. Is that, and two income earners, is that $100,000 worth of income and you can't afford to build a house? Or is it $50,000?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I'm a little hesitant to give an exact number when we have all the MHFA experts here, but I think on the slide they were talking in the neighborhood of $83,000, but that may be for a different, so it, I wouldn't, someone else in this room knows the answer to that off the top of their head.
That's a great answer.
Statewide.
Why don't you come to the, Commissioner, come to the microphone so they can hear it. So.
The maximum income limit for rental housing under the Challenge Fund is $58,000.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
So $58,000, okay, that's a pretty decent income. And Mr. Dorman, see, I used a nice term, because Mr. Dorman and I came into this legislature together. We have many stories that we will not tell. How many units statewide are you looking at over the next year or 10 years or 20 years? And do you have an actual dollar figure in today's dollar that would solve this problem? Is it $1 billion? Is it $2 billion? Because that's kind of what I'm looking at. That I've been playing with my phone and the calculator on it.
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, a good question. I don't really have a good answer to it, however. I would say as many as we can. But I think when we pulled, what we did as an organization, we pulled housing studies from probably two dozen communities, and they all show a need for this type of housing. And so it could be, I would say, up to ballpark, quick calculation, somewhere between 10 and 20,000 units. But I think that my hope would be, and this goes back to what Mr. Goodman was addressing earlier, I hope that when we stimulate the market and start some of this investment, it isn't going to all have to come from the state. So I think if the state jump starts this, I think we'll see success, and I think we'll see more private investment. But being a good House member, I'll morph from your question into a little bit of Representative.
Well, I'll cut you off there because I've got your piece right here, and said by 2020 in Duluth, Perham, Olmsted County, and Worthington, you're going to need 7,000 units just in those four areas. And if we're talking greater Minnesota, that's not including St. Cloud, that's not including Wilmer, that's not including, I guess it is Worthington. So it would be nice to have some kind of number that we could put our arms around so that we could plan as a state budget here. And then, Mr. Chair, obviously something's wrong here. Capitalism is a great thing. I really and truly believe in it. I've taught that to my kids. But if you have zero vacancy rates and they can only charge they're charging $600 or $700 and you have zero vacancy rates, what, I don't understand these landlords. What's with the $1,200 rents? I mean, that's, that would even be cheap in metro area. Why not raise the rents? If that's what the market is willing to bear, people are going to pay it. And then that would put upward pressure on the employers to actually raise the wages. I mean, I'm not trying to legislate wages, but let the market play it out. And I, no one's told me why a landlord will not raise the rates except in certified financed low-income housing. So can someone tell me why they won't raise the rates?
Mr. Dorman, did you want to finish your comments and maybe for our testifiers answer Representative Mahoney's question?
Sure, the market is broken and isn't responding. I mean, there is a problem, there's no question. I wish I had the answer to that, because it seems like, why isn't this investment? So I'll look at Albert Lea. We haven't built market rate apartments, true market rate apartments, in 30 years. And so what happens, we're not talking about $5, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour jobs. We're talking about beginning teachers that are saying, what the heck, I don't want to move to Albert Lea, I can't find a decent place. They're willing to pay more. I mean, it does not seem logical on the surface. I get that. I understand that. But we're still dealing with it, looking for solutions. But the same thing could be said of low-income housing. Well, we wouldn't need any low-income housing either if we just, you know, pay people more. I get that, but I think the is a little bit more complex to it. But I was glad that Representative Wagenius brought up the demographics between Greater Minnesota and sometimes the urban core. They're very similar. And they're very similar at times, and yet for some reason the programs seem to work better in the metropolitan area than they do in Greater Minnesota. I wish I had an answer for that. That might be very helpful and something that the committee might want to look at, because the demographics are similar, and yet when you look at where the housing dollars go and where they have went, I think, and I would have to have the spreadsheet in front of me of the $170 million that was released 2 months ago now, I think about two-thirds of it went in the metropolitan area. So there is a disconnect there somewhere where these programs are not working in Greater Minnesota as well as they should, and I think we should address that. I agree with her.
Representative Hortman, you get the last question for the day. Or for the committee hearing, not for the day. I'm not going to prohibit other committees from asking questions. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dorman, I've known Representative Garofalo a long time. I presume you've known him longer. I just wondered if you ever knew him when he had a mullet.
Good Lord.
Did you ever
copy of that picture?
Oh, can I throw this at her? Is that allowed under the rules or not?
No. I have known him for a while, and I've ridden with him in a nuclear-powered car, which I thought was kind of fun.
I thought it was
cool. It's all your fault that I bought the car. You know that. All right, members, if there's no other questions, I want to thank everyone and our testifiers for a very informal hearing. We are adjourned. Thank you.